Great. So I actually I'm going to be giving two talks. The first talk is to provide the scientific rationale for why we're advocating population-wide sodium reduction. And the second talk is actually the talk that Sonia Angel was going to give. Sonia Angel has a leadership position in the New York City Department of Health and has been spearheading their initiative to reduce sodium. Actually, the National NRSI, and I'll go over that afterwards. Okay, so I do have one disclosure. I received some honoraria from Unilever that I donated to the American Heart Association. Okay, so let's go ahead and start. One of the issues that always comes up front is that there are different units that you'll see in the medical literature, and some, even in my presentation, even if I try to use the same units, I sort of jump around a little bit. But the first, the units that you're most familiar with are probably milligrams of sodium. And the two levels that I'll talk about repeatedly are 1,500 milligrams, which is the level that's termed the adequate intake by the Institute of Medicine, and the upper level of 2,300 milligrams, which is the upper limit of intake, at least for the 2005 U.S. Dietary Guidelines. And that corresponds in millimoles to 65 and 100. And then in most of the world, though, they use sodium chloride. And that's because most sodium, probably 90%, comes in the form of sodium chloride. And these are the gram amounts. So you will see those, particularly in data that comes from England. So the reason why we're concerned about sodium is primarily because of blood pressure. So from a population perspective, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and stroke is the leading cause of death worldwide. It's been estimated that 62% of strokes and 49% of coronary heart disease events can be attributed to elevated blood pressure, and a total of approximately 26% of adults worldwide, or close to a billion individuals, have hypertension. That doesn't include, obviously, those who have pre-hypertension. But I also like to think of it from an individual perspective, because I think many of you probably are thinking, well, this is somebody else, you know, it's not me. Well, the bottom line is the lower your blood pressure, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease, even if you do not have hypertension. And secondly, your lifetime risk of developing hypertension is 90%. Great data from the Framingham Heart Study that if you reach age 50 and then you start counting at that point, 90% of those individuals will develop hypertension over their lifetime. This is a slide that from a meta-analysis of over, you know, I think a million person years, and each line corresponds to a decade of individuals. So the lowest line is people 50 to 59 years of age, and the y-axis is the risk of stroke, and the x-axis is usual systolic blood pressure. And you see that there's a progressive dose response relationship between usual blood pressure and the risk of stroke. And that occurs both above and below the definition of hypertension. Now, we can achieve really substantial public health benefits if we can shift the distribution of blood pressure in the United States just by a small amount. And it's been estimated, several people have done it, that just a reduction of, let's say, 3 millimeters of mercury would reduce mortality from stroke by about 8%, CHD by 5%, total mortality by 4%. And there's reason to believe you'd get even more than 3% with sodium reduction. Now, I did indicate that lifetime risk is 90% of developing hypertension, and that's because of a phenomenon called the age-related rise in blood pressure, which occurs as we, throughout our lifetime. This is the classic slide for adults, and it makes no difference whether you're black or white or Mexican-American. We're on one of those curves or close to it. And on average, blood pressure rises about 0.6 millimeters of mercury per year. Very insidious. You can't even measure it within an individual because the variability. But that doesn't happen uniformly. And in fact, in the INTERSALT study, there were four populations that had absolutely no age-related rise in blood pressure. Those are isolated populations that are not eating, you know, processed food, and on the x-axis you see the amount of sodium, which in those populations it's all under 1,500 milligrams of sodium, and none of those have an age-related rise. In fact, it's close to zero. Now, one of the things I found interesting when I was preparing a talk a few years ago was to understand the age-related rise in blood pressure in children. And so there is data on this. It's not as robust as adult data, but it's interesting because the average age-related rise in blood pressure in boys is 1.9 millimeters of mercury, which is roughly three times the speed or the rate in adults. And in girls, it's 1.5. So, you know, I found this sort of interesting. It's sort of like this slide connects with the last slide. But I actually found what was more interesting is to plot the average age of the Yanomami Indians, who basically don't have an age-related rise in blood pressure. So that's the average blood pressure in men, 101 over 65. That's age 20 to 59. And in women, it's 91 to 56. And these are healthy people. So then what I like to do is sort of like map out. So for men, that means that the 101 roughly corresponds to the average blood pressure of boys, age 11. So, and for women, that 91 maps out to the average blood pressure of girls, age 6. So basically what you're seeing is a phenomena where the age-related, you know, where the problem of elevated blood pressure is starting in children, you know, well before we start focusing on it in adults. And there is evidence that sodium reduction does have a benefit at very young ages. This is data from a very interesting study that was done in infants that were given formula that was either usual salt or reduced salt. And by 25 weeks, there was a reduction in blood pressure of about 2 millimeters of mercury. And then there was a follow-up study, and about a third of the people had follow-up blood pressure done about 15 years later, and they had about a 3 millimeter reduction in blood pressure. So there appears to be some memory effect from a reduced sodium intake in children. Most of the studies that we have deal with or where we try to estimate the effects of sodium reduction is on through blood pressure, but there is a set of studies that where there is some outcome data. These are not perfect studies by any means because they're sort of secondary analyses and secondary outcomes, but in each case, sodium reduction appears to reduce mortality. Sometimes it was combined with increased potassium intake, as was done in the Taiwan veterans study. So let me just go dive down, you know, further under the sheets here and discuss some of the rationale for, you know, the levels that we chose. So the Institute of Medicine Committee that I showed you on met in early around 2001, 2002, 2003, and we had to consider the adverse effects of excess salt intake. So we believe our assessment was that there was an established relationship with increased blood pressure, which would lead to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke. That there's a probable relationship with gastric cancer, and that's been best demonstrated through ecologic studies, but also some studies in China where there's very high rates of gastric cancer. And then there's suggestive relationship, which I think is really interesting and where there needs to be more research, which is that as sodium intake increases, so does appears to be the risk of osteoporosis. At least you see increased urinary calcium excretion that would potentially lead to osteoporosis. And also in cross-sectional studies and one small clinical trial, relationship between increased salt intake and less left ventricular mass. And then there is also a hypothesized relationship between sodium intake and overweight or obesity. The studies so far have really focused mostly on blood pressure rather than cardiovascular disease events, in large part because you're dealing with lifelong exposures, decades, and it's really not amenable to clinical trials with hard outcomes. But these are the types of studies that we have available, probably more data than for many of the other types of nutrient/disease relations. So there's epidemiologic data, migration studies, genetic studies. Actually, almost each of the sort of monogenetic determinants of blood pressure appears to affect sodium excretion by the kidney or the kidney's processing of sodium. Virtually all animal forms of hypertension are aggravated by salt. And we do have trials, dose response studies in children and adults, and then we have some population intervention studies as well. And so let me just show you a few of the trials of sodium reduction on blood pressure. As I said, there are about 10 dose response studies. And this is perhaps the best study of them all, which is in the largest study of them all, the disodium trial that was published about 10 years ago. And it documents a dose-response relationship in both a typical American diet, our control diet, as well as the DASH diet. And you see going from a level around 1,500 milligrams on the furthest on the left, going to the right, you see increases in blood pressure as sodium intake rises. And this is a tightly controlled study. So one of the problems with this whole area is measurement of sodium, and as well as counseling individuals. It's very difficult to achieve, you know, sodium contrast because it's ubiquitous, because sodium is ubiquitous in the population. These are data that really summarize the average intakes of average blood pressure reductions in the left on children, non-hypertensive individuals, hypertensive individuals. And in the right, there was I put down one trial, and I'll emphasize it's one trial, because you're not going to have many more of these studies. This is a very unique study that was done in resistant hypertension, individuals on three or more medications who had poorly controlled hypertension. And huge blood pressure reductions, 22 over 9. And this was a feeding study that was very well done, very tightly controlled, impressive study. You will often hear the concept salt sensitivity, which is, I think it's a legitimate biologic concept, but it actually has very little relevance from a public health perspective. So we can identify groups that have greater response to sodium. But there's tremendous variability within group, and it's impossible to identify salt-sensitive individuals, and I'll show you some data on that. And as I said, it's irrelevant as a public health concept, given the vast scope of the blood pressure and cardiovascular disease epidemics. So there are factors that are associated with salt sensitivity. There are what I call fixed factors. So African Americans tend to have a greater blood pressure response to differences, changes in sodium, as do middle and older age individuals, individuals with certain genetic factors, and then individuals with hypertension, diabetes, and chronic renal insufficiency, although, well, truth in lending, there's not as much data in those two groups. There are two modifiable determinants. One is low potassium intake. Diets that are low in potassium, you'll see a greater blood pressure response to sodium intake, as well as a poor quality diet. These are data from the DASH sodium study that show differences in blood pressure reduction between African Americans and non-African Americans. And I actually want to emphasize two things. One is both groups benefit, but you see a bit more benefit in African Americans. And you also see it see the same thing by age, with greater blood pressure reduction in individuals over age 45 compared to those less than 45. But again, both groups benefit on average. This gets at the point I mentioned earlier about the problem with intrinsic variability in blood pressure, which you really don't probably appreciate unless you're a pencil-headed investigator like myself. Blood pressure is not a very precise phenotype. You measure it today, and you measure it tomorrow. You take the difference between those two values, and you get a big distribution. So even if you measure blood pressure very well and on repeated occasions, and then you do it again when the person is on the same diet, eating the same food, again, very well on multiple occasions, and take the difference between those two, you think, well, it should be zero, you know, because nothing's really changed. But this actually shows you what the whole spread is. It goes from about minus 25 to plus 25. And this is in a feeding study where we control the intake. So this gives you an idea of how much noise there is with blood pressure as a phenotype and why you really cannot, at an individual level, determine salt sensitivity. Again, this is blood pressure differences when there is no change in diet or sodium. And this is what happens if you just reduce sodium, but you keep the same diet. So you see basically a shift in the distribution downward. This is data from the DASH sodium study. Okay. So on the basis of the data that I've showed you, I know it's somewhat synthesized and summarized, the Institute of Medicine set two numbers. One is an adequate intake level of 1,500 milligrams per day, and an upper limit of adults of 2,300 milligrams per day. Now, about a year or two after that, the dietary guidelines interpreted the Institute of Medicine report and came up with their own set of recommendations, which was a limit for the general population of 2,300 milligrams per day, and then a lower limit that corresponds to that adequate intake level of 1,500 milligrams. And they did, and they set that for middle-aged and older-age persons, blacks, and individuals with hypertension, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease. Since then, the first report out of the gate to set a lower level was a report from the American Heart Association that set strategic goals for 2020. Very ambitious goals related to achieving cardiovascular health. And in that, they set what they call a diet quality score, which where there were five components of the diet, and one of the components was to achieve a sodium intake under 1,500 milligrams. That was the goal that they set. I served on the Dietary Guidelines Committee, so I'm going to bore you with a few slides, but it's very these slides have actually sort of captured the essence of some of the decision making that went into the 1,500 milligrams. So we concluded that a strong body of evidence has documented that in adults, as blood pressure, as sodium intake decreases, so does blood pressure. And second bullet, a moderate body of evidence has documented that as sodium intake decreases, so does blood pressure in children. Okay? So implications. The current food supply is replete with excess sodium. Many foods contribute, it's not just a few very high foods. Secondly, while some foods are extremely high in sodium, the problem of excess sodium reflects frequent consumption of foods that are only modestly increased sodium. That's why you have to reduce sodium in a lot of foods, not just the high sodium foods. A major new concern is the excessive sodium added to products such as poultry, pork, and fish through injections or marinations. Efforts to quantify the amount of the sodium from this type of processing is warranted. And we did not find good data on this published or tracked. And the fourth bullet in this slide, an important determinant of sodium intake is calorie intake. Hence, efforts to reduce calorie intake might also lower sodium intake. Implications. In 2005, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines recommended daily intake of less than 2,300 for the general population and an intake of 1,500 for the higher risk groups. And then second bullet, because the latter groups now comprise nearly 70% of the U.S. adults, the goal should be 1,500 milligrams per day for the general population. All right. Implications. Given the current U.S. marketplace and the resulting excessively high sodium intake, it'll be challenging to achieve the lower goal. Thus, reduction should occur incrementally from 2,300 to 1,500 milligrams over time. And a recent Institute of Medicine report has provided a roadmap to achieve that. Okay? So that what we basically said was we know that it's going to be hard, you know, but we think that this should be done. And this is what the state of the world looks like. The NCI published this data. It's on their website. And this shows you the average sodium intake by age, by men, women, boys, girls, you know, throughout the lifespan. And really, virtually every group is above the 1,500 milligrams on average now. And some really high numbers in kids 14 to 18 and 19 to 30. So let me switch now to some of the data that has come out since then, where we actually have tried to estimate the number of deaths associated. I know that this is going to be part of the next speaker's talks, but that there are a large number of estimated deaths attributable to non-optimal levels of risk factors. So this was from DNI, and roughly 100,000 deaths in 2005 could have been averted if sodium intake was reduced to, at this point, I think the benchmark was 2,300, not 1,500. And there have been several groups that have tried to quantify this further, and one is Bibbins-Domingo, published in New England Journal from earlier this year. And what they did was to try to estimate the number of heart attacks and deaths that would be averted through reductions in salt. So this is where we switched from sodium to salt, so I apologize. So just a fairly modest reduction of of 1 gram per day would lead to a reduction in heart attacks of 32,000 to 28,000 deaths. And if you sort of reduce salt even further, the reductions are even more substantial and actually mirror what you would get from drug therapy for hypertension, smoking cessation if you got 50%, or weight loss of 5%. We know how challenging that is. So this concludes the sort of the first part of my talk. The estimated benefits of salt reduction are substantial and warrant major public health efforts to reduce salt intake. So I could stop there, I guess, 10 more minutes. So let me just go ahead with the presentation that Sonia Angel would have given. And I'll confess, these are not my slides, so I will be reading more than I will be telling out of my own, personal insights, although I've worked with Sonia on a few different initiatives. So she leads the National Salt Reduction Initiative, and you'll see the acronym NSRI, which is not just New York City. It involves numerous professional groups and other cities and states, and it's a voluntary framework to reduce sodium intake. There have been some attempts to estimate trends over time. This is one slide that shows it using NHANES data. These data are not perfect by any means, but it shows you that in all instances, average intake is really at or close to the 2,300 milligrams and much higher than what the 1,500 milligrams that I just mentioned has been proposed for the 2010 U.S. Dietary Guidelines. The big problem, of course, is processed and restaurant foods, which together account for about 77% of the sodium that we consume. Only 12% is natural, and this is what we sort of put in our food while we consume. I will emphasize that these are old data, and I think that they've been presented probably 2,000 to 3,000 times, and yet there are only 60 people in this study. So I think that the inspiration for the NRSI actually comes out of the UK, where there's a salt reduction campaign spearheaded by by Graham McGregor, who provides sort of the intellectual firepower for this initiative, and their goal is to reduce salt intake by about a third from 2005 to 2010. And they've got many commitments from a variety of sectors. And what they try to do is actually reduce sodium gradually in many products. So they're not focusing just, again, on the high salt, high sodium or high salt. So these are some of the initiatives or some of the product reductions that they've achieved from Heinz, from Nestle, from Kellogg's, and from Kraft's. And they have some early salt intake data that indicates about a 10% reduction, which I think is actually pretty impressive, it's a public health campaign, and to see some traction even over 3 or 4 years, I think is impressive. Now, the Institute of Medicine, as I mentioned earlier, wants to move beyond voluntary. So the primary strategy that we set, Sonia and I were on the same panel, was that the FDA should initiate a process to set mandatory national standards. And that's what's on the table. That's, I think, what's being considered by the FDA. But they actually, in the interim, want to continue some of the efforts like NRSI, because you don't want to undercut, in part because the first objective could take years. I mean, when you think about how long it takes to change labels, it's almost, trying to move glaciers. The goal of the NSRI is a 20% reduction of sodium intake in 5 years, and what they want to do is to accomplish this in individuals by reducing the sodium content of foods by 25% over the same period, and it will be done through reformulations and reductions in a variety of food groups. So they've there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle, and I can only sort of scratch the surface. They have databases where they try to understand the amount of sodium in the products and then hold meetings with industry, generate targets, categories and targets, and do that both for packaged food and restaurant foods. And what they're doing, they're actually collecting 24-hour urines. They did it at a baseline, and then they're going to do it in a few years to see if they can replicate what happened in the UK with sodium reduction. So the partners are national health organizations, cities, states, and these are the groups they're trying to influence. Restaurant food, packaged food. And I think this is actually really interesting and ambitious, because we often ignore the restaurant food as being too difficult. You know, it's just a tough nut to crack. As I said, it's a national effort, and we have, you know, really all the major players here: American College of Cardiology, Epidemiology, ADA, Dietetic Association, AHA, American Medical Association, this group, the APHA, American Society of Hypertension as well. So, I mean, it's a very big coalition, you know, that's signed on board for this. And a lot of states and cities as well. I think even Baltimore might have gotten on there, or maybe it was, yep, right there. Good. Feel proud of that. So this is their timeline. So I think there were meetings. I think I participated in that meeting in 2009, and then they announced their targets. And you know, it's a good program, and I think it pays to have a mayor who has a public school, public health, named after him, because I think he provides the support for this. Here he is, you know, with that's Nancy Brown, who's CEO of the American Heart Association. I think that's Tom Fairley, the commissioner. I mean, you know, he's on board, as he is with a lot of other public health initiatives, and there's gotten several groups also interested as well. Gotten some traction also with the press. You can see these are some of the stories. And as I said, there's monitoring and evaluation with the 24-hour urine. So one of the things that's a bit different, like from the other initiatives in New York City, is it really is a national effort, which I think, you probably heard this, you know, the trite phrase, you know, as California goes, so goes the nation. I think in this case, as New York City goes, so goes the nation. I think that's very impressive. And so if you want to learn more about it, here's a website, and I guess answer a few questions now before the next speaker. Yes.
With athletes who drink electrolyte replacement drinks and that sort of thing, is that a factor for these recommendations when you are excessively exercising and physically active?
Well, that's actually an interesting issue. So the issue is, what is the optimum sodium intake or even potassium intake in athletes? So let's sort of first go below the one thing, is that we're not dealing with professional. Most people are not professional athletes out on, you know, playing for the Denver Broncos. Most are sort of casual athletes, and I think the evidence is not there for any sodium, you know, any special requirements for sodium. If they just, you know, I think there's more of an issue for just avoiding dehydration. Now, this is the average athlete, you know, the high school athlete that is not, you know, not exercising in 100 degree weather, but is, you know, maybe, you know, even running cross country or track or something like this, but maybe just an hour a day or an hour and a half. There actually have been some interesting studies, and if you want a reference, there's a reference by ALSOOP, A-L-S-O-O-P, who did a fascinating study where he took individuals that were exposed to heat, okay, so he kept the heat constant, but he had three different levels of sodium intake. One was usual, one was low, and one was very low. And what happened was the individuals reduced the amount of sodium that they excreted in their urine and in their stool and in their sweat in response to the lower levels. So So what happened is that the body started to hold on to more in the setting of, when sodium was reduced. And so one of the things I've been concerned about when I hear about, you know, athletes that are consuming excess sodium is that you're sort of like in a, you're in a loop now where they're consuming excess sodium, they're losing sodium. For most athletes, it just doesn't likely make a difference. But there's also very little data on that, you know. We don't have good clinical trials, so, and it's a long-winded answer to a short question, but that provides hopefully some context. I mean, I run a lot myself. I ran a half an hour today. I ran an hour yesterday. I don't go out of my way to consume any more sodium than what I would get, you know, by breathing. Yes. At an individual restaurant, because I think the Bibbins Domingo article, and I think even your article, I think have done looked at smaller versus larger, you know, reductions. But I think, you know. I'm not sure if that's been done at the level of the at the level of, you know, the restaurant industry. Yes.
Yeah. A quick question. In light of regulation and anti-government and framing the reduction, how do you see it play out in terms of acceptance?
Yeah. This is I mean, I think a lot of us are disheartened by what happened last week. And you know, I view, you know, many of the problem, the issues related to prevention as public health issues affecting huge populations. I think they will get more traction. I had an interesting conversation earlier, though, that what this does, though, it actually I think we haven't messaged quite accurately what's the benefits, but also how that by reducing sodium in the food supply, you actually give individuals more flexibility. You know, if they want to, they can add the sodium back in. You know, they could always add it back in. But it's almost impossible to start high and then reduce, you know. And so we haven't gotten a easy message out that sodium reduction at a population-wide basis actually enhances individual choice, which I think is the mantra of what, you know, a lot of people are saying. Individuals have to have choice. Right now, you do not have choice. You know, you're stuck. Yes. Right.
And much of that has to do with choice. Because when we look at things' behavior in terms of choice, that's number one. And so in trying to replace sodium in food production, you know, they often add sugar and fats and other substitutes. So is this initiative addressing that issue as well as increasing sodium?
Okay. Well, just to the first part of your question, I'm writing a grant on sodium reduction and sodium heart failure, and that was the PI, Frank Sachs. For the first part of your question is that, the impact of sodium reduction on taste and these niche products, you know, it was a lousy strategy to have these niche products. You can accomplish what we're doing here without labeling a single product as low sodium. You know, what we're advocating is basically it gets reduced by so much, you don't have to label it. You know, it's, you know, there's nothing medicinal about it. You get 5%, 10% or so. What happens, though, and this is an industry complaint that's quite valid, is that they don't get credit for gradual reductions. They get credit for large reductions, and that's how they can label stuff. And they feel like they're doing stuff now, but they're not really getting a lot of credit for it. But most, you know, what we're advocating now is gradual reduction, and in the UK, there have been really no major complaints about the sodium being reduced. In fact, there also have been, I was at a panel of, actually on an IOM panel, where there are companies now that have reduced their sodium, again, silently, no complaints. Campbell's has reduced from 800 down to 480 in several of their product lines, no complaints. Taste, if done with taste in mind, you can get there. Your concern about, you know, replacement of other, you know, with other, you know, products, I'm not quite sure how much that really happens. You know, I don't have data on that. I think it'd be interesting to see, if, you know, if there's really a thread of truth. I'm not so sure about it. Yes. Okay.